Tonight on Arena, Brian McGilloway on his latest thriller, The One You Least Suspect, and Dublin pianist Daniel Luke on his very musical family. Five on 551 is the text, and you can get us on X or on Instagram at RTE Arena. Widely considered to be one of Irish crime fiction's leading lights, Brian McGilloway has just published his 13th novel, The One You Least Suspect, which is set against the backdrop of the illegal drug trade in Northern Ireland. And delighted to have Brian join me right now. The character here, Katie Hamill, young woman, who finds herself really between a rock and a hard place. That's the dilemma. That's the drama of the novel, Brian.
Yeah, it is. And thanks for having me on, Sean. At the start of the book, Katie finds herself put into a very difficult situation where she is kind of pulled aside a morning after a wedding that she attended by two detectives. Who show her photographs of her and her family from the past 6 months and put her under pressure to become an informant on her boss, a pub owner, and his brother.
And the brother is involved in the whole in drug dealing, and the pub owner, with whom we think is actually not the worst fella in the world, turns out isn't the nicest fella in the world either.
I suppose the way that it's presented to her is that she doesn't have to do anything. She just has to be herself.
Yeah.
But if she hears anything interesting in the bar, if she passes this information on, they'll help her out with presents for her daughter for Christmas and stuff. And of course, because of the kind of the history of the place, she immediately refuses.
That's what I was going to ask you about. It's the history of the place that, you know, here we are in a post-Troubles, thankfully, Northern Ireland, but here we are in Derry City, and it seems as if this young woman, you know, is really in the place people found themselves in during the Troubles, where perhaps they were approached by somebody to inform on somebody else, and the stigma around being the tout, that was as the word was used, or the informant, it was more than a stigma at that time. It could lead to very serious consequences for the person who would be considered to be an informer. Has it changed in Katie's world? Are you looking at how it has just shifted into a slightly different a slightly different place?
I don't know if it has. I kind of weirdly, after I wrote the book, and I was thinking about where it had come from, because I never have an agenda. When I start a book, I don't really know what it's going to be about. And the book is my way of kind of feeling my way through my own views on topics. One of the things that kind of came to mind was my first day at school. The one piece of advice that my father gave me my first day at secondary school was, you keep your ears open and your mouth shut. And that was just kind of the mentality that we grew up with. It was that whatever you say, say nothing. Every town had their version of say nothing until you see, insert the name of the local solicitor or whatever. It was just, we were kind of brought up in that way, that you kind of kept your powder dry, you said nothing, and kind of assessed the ground. Mm. And I don't know if that has necessarily changed that much. I think it's a generational thing. I met a schoolmate a couple of weeks ago at a festival in Oxford. And we were talking about justice, and he said, I still have that mentality. I've never been able to break it. Even in day-to-day dealings, I kind of find myself biting my tongue and kind of waiting to test the ground before I decide where I'm going to step. I think maybe our the next generation, like my kids, I don't think would have that same kind of say nothing mentality. Because social media and everything else, I think, has possibly encouraged their generation to almost share,
say everything
at times. But it also means that they've got very, very good, I suppose, at being able to suss people out in a different way.
And you're saying, Brian, that you know when you set out to write a novel, you're telling a story and you're telling it in the thriller genre. You want us to be turning the page to find out what happens next, what's going to happen to whom, and that's what The One You Least Suspect does. We are following it in that fashion. But one thing that you must have decided, or did you decide early on, it is Katie, the lead character, who speaks to us in the first person. Now, you had done this with your Inspector Ben Devlin books. He spoke to us in the first person. You then had Lucy Black, who was the female protagonist, younger cop. Those series of novels
That's
were in the
right.
third person.
Yeah,
but here you are, you're giving Katie her voice. She starts on the first page of the novel telling me, I did this, or I was at, it all started when I was at the wedding, when I was at Gail's wedding. How conscious was that shift, and what did it allow you to do regarding that female voice?
I'd used a first person female voice on the last book, which was a book called The Empty Room, about a mother whose daughter disappears. And I kind of, particularly, I suppose, with that book and with Katie, because the two of them almost feel a bit like companion novels in some ways. But with Katie in particular, I liked the idea that this is somebody that everybody underestimates. She's not some kind of tragic heroine. She's not some kind of flawed hero. She's just a normal person who's going about her business. She's a barmaid. She's got a daughter, so she's a single mum with a four-year-old child. And everybody underestimates her. Everybody assumes that she will do what they tell them on both sides, because really, as you said at the start, she gets caught between really two kind of contrasting and yet parallel forces that are as bad as one another in the things that they do. And both of them assume that they can and underestimate her. And I kind of felt that it needed to be written from her perspective. It needed to be to create that sense of claustrophobia, that sense of being trapped and not being able to see a way out. I kind of needed to be inside her head.
Inside her and let her lead us through the story. There is a kind of a bleakness and an awful negativity to this thought that the special branch, these two men, what does she call them? English and what
and black hair.
Black hair in English. She doesn't know their name. English and black hair. That these two special branch men are as capable of backing her into a corner and essentially, they're prepared to give her presents and money to buy the daughter stuff for Christmas, but they're equally prepared to go on the negative side of that and set up situations where she could possibly have the child taken off her. It's awful to think that these special branch men are as bad in the way they act as the drug dealing family.
Well, I mean, I suppose the things that happen in the book, she's never 100% sure that they have done it. But it's kind of the machinery of bureaucracy that is used against her at times, more than anything else. The kind of benefits that suddenly get frozen and kind of agencies that start getting involved with her family. And at each of it, she kind of comments at one stage about how it's all designed to make you comply. Or to make her comply. I kind of liked that concept. I mean, the working title for it was The Dirty War. And it was about that kind of idea about what people are prepared to do to justify when they think they're right. And that's really, I suppose, what I was aiming for with both forces. Because both sides that she's kind of trapped between believe that they represent the community, that they are protecting the community, and that they're justified in doing whatever it is that they do, because it's kind of, well, the end justifies the means.
And to what extent, Brian, do you think you are directly reflecting Northern Irish society as you see it by saying that?
It's certainly, it would have been when I was growing up that you would have had that kind of sense of that there were these forces that were kind of operating. And I mean, because I grew up in Derry, and I mean, the events like Bloody Sunday, I mean, there was a very, I suppose growing up, we were acutely aware that lawmakers could be lawbreakers, that the two things weren't mutually exclusive. And I'm always kind of fearful about anybody who is kind of fervent in their certainty about anything. I kind of, we increasingly, I feel like we're kind of moving towards a world of to kind of black and white and sides. And I think social media, again, it's just, I mean, even when you're on some of the social media sites, it's horrific. They're just the extremes. And people, I mean, even something like the election of Pope Leo, seeing both sides claim kind of victory as if, look at this, this proves us right. And it's the fact that both kind of, both left and right, if you like, in terms of politics, we're both claiming a victory over the same person who probably is nowhere near the extreme on either side and probably would consider themselves somewhere to be in the middle. But it's that idea of certainty and the kind of fervor that can carry people into believing that whatever they do is justified.
One of the other aspects of always there in your books, I mean, right back to the very beginning, the first Benedict Devlin story, Borderlands. The border is always there, and it's no coincidence that when Katie, when the book opens, she's at a wedding in Donegal, and or being from Derry. I suppose you're from that neck of the woods. I mean, I'm from Monaghan myself. I have a similar thing, just a bit further south, if you like. But it's impossible not to mine the kind of the possibilities that dividing line gives you as a novelist. What do you see them as, Brian?
Yeah, I mean, again, and an awful lot of this comes from whenever we were kids and I was growing up. I mean, I remember whenever you, because we used to cross the border certainly every weekend, we would have gone from Derry to Buncrana for a run, which ironically didn't involve any physical movement. It was just sitting in a car for an hour and a half. Normally because my mum loved chef brown sauce, which you couldn't buy in the north, but you could get in Buncrana. So we used to do these kind of condiment runs every weekend. But I remember very, very clearly you kind of drove through this military hangar on the northern side, and then there was a space of about 300-400 yards before you got to the customs post, and it was that area in the middle. And I remember very clearly as a kid kind of sitting in the boot of the car, because we only had a 5-seater when there were 6 of us in the family, and because I was the youngest, I was relegated to rolling around the boot, and I was kind of looking out at this space going, who owns this? And that still sticks in my head, that fact that there was this unpoliced area, this kind of jurisdiction. And that was the idea with Borderlands, that kind of grey area, because Devlin crosses the border frequently, morally, ethically, and physically. He kind of...
This is your ongoing character in the first series of books.
So the border has always been that for me. It's always been that kind of porous membrane. And then I stopped writing about it really with the fifth Devlin, which was about 2012, 2013, because I suppose post Good Friday Agreement and the St Andrews Agreement, there was a sense that the border really, even though it was still there, it had physically vanished, and psychologically had fairly much vanished. Yeah. You weren't aware of it. I mean, my kids had absolutely no knowledge of it at all. They just didn't. And where we live, the cinema is in the south, and we live just in the north. So even if you're going to the cinema, you're crossing the border, but it's nothing. Do you know what I mean? It means nothing.
Yeah, because during the Troubles when you were talking about there, you went to Buncrana to get the chef sauce. We went to Armagh to get the opal fruits. I mean, that was what we were looking for, and spangles, which didn't exist in the south. But it was very clearly demarcated, and that no man's land, you'd have a yellow kind of box on the road and a white box, which they said was for the helicopters to see so that they would know what jurisdiction they were in. But there was that in-between space that was the kind of no man's land.
Yeah, and it was between kind of one military hangar and a kind of a police checkpoint or a Garda checkpoint or a customs checkpoint. And particularly kind of if you were heading up from Strabane, if you were kind of heading up that way out down towards Sligo with that, it was on a bridge even more. So you were kind of, you went through the military hangar on one side of the bridge and then you crossed over this bridge and the river that the border was running down the centre of. So it has always been there. And I suppose that also because I grew up in Derry, which is also kind of split by a river. And politically, when I was young, there was a sense that it was kind of divided according to the banks of the river. Thankfully, that I think has lessened an awful lot. And I think the city kind of, rather than the two sides turning their backs on one another, the city's kind of embracing the river and kind of almost gathering itself around it.
Yeah, and both at least looking towards the river and as a result looking towards each other.
Absolutely, yeah. And even something as simple as the Peace Bridge, which has kind of encouraged people to walk from one side to the other. I mean, I think all of those things are important. And then I think Brexit, whether we like it or not, Brexit started the conversation about borders again. The key thing, I think, always was going to be the psychological border. It wasn't the physical one. It was the psychological one. And the psychological one had lessened. And Brexit forced people to have to start thinking about it again. And so it's possibly no surprise that borders have kind of reappeared a bit in the books. But it is also a reflection, just as you say. I mean, if you live in a border area, you're backwards and forwards across.
Yeah,
and three or four times a day, and that's just the reality.
And the reality also will be, for some period of time, petrol will be cheaper in the south.
Absolutely,
and then it'll change, and it'll be cheaper in the north. The direction of travel will depend on where it's cheaper. We've mentioned the Inspector Devlin series, which was the first five or six. Was it five or six? Benedict.
There was six. There were five initially, and then I did. I went back to him with blood ties.
Is he done, or do you think there's more in him?
He's not done. My publisher has kind of, because the last book was a standalone, and it's been a while since the Devlin series. I think they're kind of doing another standalone, kind of the Dilemma novel. Devlin is my kind of default voice. His voice is probably the closest to mine, and he tends to be the character that I write when I'm writing about something personal. So I kind of stopped with The Nameless Dead and kind of felt, when I finished that, which was, as I say, I think around 2012, I felt as if I was done. And then my dad passed away 6 years ago, the next week, actually. And I wanted to write about that. I wanted to write about loss and grief and fathers and sons. And as soon as I sat down to write, it was Devlin's voice. Devlin. And this was about 9 years after I'd written the last one or something. And it just instinctively, it was his voice which started the story. And I just went, right. And it felt right that he should be the one that told that story.
And Lucy Black then. Lucy Black in some ways was almost like an antidote, I guess, for you as a writer of the series, because you had this young woman, a police officer, dealing with things across that series of four. Does she have a particular function, if that's the right way of putting it, within your writing life?
I think she was, I mean, what I kind of wanted to do with the Devlin books were very much about looking at kind of issues here from a remove, kind of literally from a remove across the border. So whenever I first started writing Borderlands, Devlin initially was going to be an RUC officer, and for a variety of reasons, some practical and some personal, I just kind of decided, no, I'm not going to do that, and made him a Garda officer, which allowed me to kind of take a step back and almost look at kind of events just across the river, almost, if you like.
Yes.
And he makes his sorties over the border, and he works with Jim Hendry, who is an RUC inspector. And by the time we had kind of three boys in a row, and then my daughter is our youngest.
So you had to go there.
And when she was born, I kind of wanted to write a story. I wanted to write a fairy tale. To be totally honest, I wanted to write a kind of a gothic fairy tale about a child who is found in a woodland who won't speak. And somebody sits with her in the hospital. Her parent, no family members claimed her. She's obviously witnessed something traumatic. And a police officer sits with her at night, and to pass the time, begins reading her stories from a book of fairy tales. And one of the fairy tales triggers a reaction. And I knew straight away that it couldn't be Devlin, that it had to be somebody else. It had to be somebody who wasn't married. It had to be somebody probably younger. It had to be a female.
So Lucy Black was born. Well, whichever direction you go in next, Brian, I hope it brings you to a good place.
Well, thank you.
In the meantime, the current standalone novel by Brian McGilloway is called The One You Least Suspect. It is published by Constable. Daniel Luke is a pianist and composer from Dublin. His 2023 debut album, Shadow Dance, featured a series of minimalist pieces and marked a shift in the style of music that he was making. Since then, he has moved into film scoring and released new compositions, including My Father's Son, a duet for piano and cello, and All in Light, a solo piano piece accompanied by a short film. Daniel grew up in Cabra with his three brothers, James, Liam and Kevin, all of whom are musicians. Kevin is better known to many of us as the rapper and visual artist Kojak, but it is Daniel who is with us in studio this evening. No nickname, no other name that you go by, Daniel?
No, Daniel will do,
Daniel is what you're sticking with.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking of your household. I think you started playing drums.
Yeah, well, I would have started on piano initially, when I was very young, like 6 or 7. And then when I got to my teens, discovered the drums, and they kind of quickly took over. Seemed kind of a more interesting thing to be doing as a teenager.
Yeah, so you were beating the lard out of the drums. Kevin was involved pretty much in the rapping, I suppose, from at that point as well. What about James? James and Liam, what were they doing around the house?
A bit of everything as well. So we all would have done piano initially. James and Liam, they're both amazing guitarists and singers, the two of them. That's kind of their main thing now, yeah.
And never any chat about potential four-piece?
We haven't done a four-piece, no. Myself and James were in a band for years together.
Which band was that?
Gypsies on the Autobahn.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So
you were the drummer in that.
I was the drummer
drummer in Gypsies on the Autobahn.
Exactly, yeah.
All right, but the music that you have in for us this evening and the music that you have been exploring now as yourself, separate from your three brothers in many ways, is very much piano music. What was your route to the piano? Well, you like, yes, you learned as a kid, as did your brothers. What was your route back to the piano and the sort of composing that you're doing now?
The route back would have been, I suppose, in my early 20s, I would have always played the piano, even alongside the drums, but I just kind of focused more on the drums for a couple of years. But I actually just was listening to some Debussy's Clair de Lune, and I just really wanted to learn that piece. So that was actually, I'd say that was my route back into...
It was that straightforward, just a piece that you wanted to learn?
I wanted to learn it, and then it just kind of reignited my love. I'd kind of forgotten how much I loved the instrument. And from there, I got serious about piano, so... End up doing all my grades and 2 teaching diplomas.
So you got yourself to a pretty high level. And to get yourself to, beyond grade 8 and 2 teaching diplomas, you were playing serious repertoire would be demanding in terms of just the hours you'd have to put in simply at the piano.
There was many, many hours. Yeah, I would have been practicing a couple of hours a day for the guts of 4 or 5 years. But yeah, I suppose that's what it took to get there. And then it was after finishing the diploma, I suppose I kind of suffered a bit of burnout from just kind of serious repertoire stuff. So I needed a change and ended up taking some jazz lessons with an amazing jazz organist called Dara Hennessy. Did about a year of that, and that kind of changed the way my brain was working with piano. It kind of put me more into a composing mind frame,
frame
I suppose.
Of mind, yeah. And the two pieces that I have this evening, both of them quite recent compositions.
Yeah.
My Father's Son is clearly a deeply personal story. What do you want to tell me about the inspiration behind this? Because there's an accompanying video which is very moving, very touching.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I really appreciate that. Yeah, so that was written essentially as a conversation, the piano and cello, as a conversation between myself and my late father. I suppose it was a way to get into...
What age were you when he died?
I would have been 6, 6 or 7. Yeah. So I suppose it was a way to kind of talk to him, or just supposed to speak in in emotional terms with him.
Mm.
And that was the inspiration behind it and with the video.
And tell us a bit about the content of the video, because watching the video as you're listening to the music is such a wonderful experience. Mm. But as I say, very touching and very moving.
Yeah, so kind of developed the idea for the video with Gar Cleary, who was the director. And again, the idea was to try to portray the last day in his life, and but more so as a way of what I imagined him thinking about, like maybe looking back over the years and over the memories, rather than kind of focusing on the tragedy of the thing.
Yeah, and one of the aspects of that, looking back over the memories, is actual family footage of you. I think maybe all four of you are there.
At some point, at different ages.
And is it your dad who's in the video? I mean, there are little scenes where the baby's been fed and where children have been played with.
That would have been my dad, yeah. Mm. And because my mum, she got a camcorder when we were very young, and she was actually just really good at video and kind of everything. And we have hours and hours of that footage, so.
Yeah, so you just took little sections from that.
Mm.
Let's have a listen to a little bit of My Father's Son. As you say, it's you at the piano here in your composition. And who's playing cello?
That's Lizzie Murta.
Lizzie Murta playing cello, as we'll hear. My Father's Son from Daniel Luke. A section there from My Father's Son, composition by Daniel Luke for piano and cello, and Lizzie Murta, the cellist, and it was Daniel himself playing the piano in that piece. As I say, Daniel, I mean, it's dealing directly with your father's death when you were just six, and all of the emotions and those family, the video that goes along with it, those little family camcorder things from the 1990s, really, really touching. When you're playing that, Can you let yourself go into those emotions, or do you have to stay way back from that type of activity?
I suppose it's hard when you're so close to the music. It kind of the emotion, it's always there, but it's kind of veiled a little bit, or it's you're slightly apart from it. I do find myself going into it very much so, depending on the room or the night. Or I've had some very emotional performances of it in the past, so.
Yeah, and the cello, I must say, adds such a layer of emotion to the piece itself.
Yeah,
it really does it come across in that fashion. You were saying as we were listening to it that your mother was the driving force behind the music for all four of you.
She was, yeah, she was. It was her that got us all into piano from a young age, and then kind of from there, whenever we took a whim for any kind of musical instrument, we were just bought the instrument and then given lessons. So we all went into Tin Whistle, Kyoltis for a little while, and then guitar and drums. And she just seemed to be amazingly good at.
And had either she or your father any musical background?
She has some. She's a singer. She sings in choirs and she played piano. I can't remember what grade up to, but we would have heard her playing when we were younger.
Yeah,
time.
So that
always
was,
singing. So that she'd was, always just a lover of music as well. Like
that was always there in the background. And in terms of, you know, if you had the four brothers trying to get to the piano, because you're all quite close in age. Who's older than you? So
James is the eldest. Mm. So there's only 11 months and a bit between the two of us.
And then the two younger brothers are.
There's about 4 years between
three or four
next,
years,
yeah.
both younger than you then. Yeah. So was there much rivalry, quite simply, to get to the piano and do the practice?
Not so much. I think actually doing the practice probably wasn't happening that much when we were that age. But so no, we were okay, and we all had our other things that we were doing as well. So,
and you have dipped in and out of the other projects, I would guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it's actually a great thing having people you're so close with as creative kind of partnerships. So we've all worked on each other's stuff in different ways. Like James would be a recording engineer producer, so he helps out with like mixing and kind of recording stuff. And Liam is a graphic designer as well. So, you know, Kev is an amazing visual artist and producer. So yeah, we're all kind of helping each other out the whole time. So.
Yeah, and the other aspect that I'm wondering about this is, you know, I said that you're composing straightforward pieces for the concert hall, which are just for performance, which certainly My Father's Son would fit into that category. But you're also writing, or you have been writing for screen, for film and TV, is it?
I did a master's last year in scoring for film and TV with Pulse College, so graduated there in September or October. So I've been doing a couple of short films so far and kind of looking into getting more into that world, because I really enjoy the process of kind of composing with something very concrete in mind.
Yeah.
Rather than, I don't know, trying to untangle whatever's going on in your own head. It's nice to have that concrete thing that you're reacting to.
And I guess in the case of when you're composing for screen like that, there are times when all you're looking for is a little short motif that you might get 15 or 20 seconds out of, whereas when you're composing, you need something that will give you the basis of an entire piece.
Absolutely. And composing like for a concert hall, you know, the whole piece has to be engaging and has to be... it has to be all-encompassing. Whereas for the screen, almost it's better sometimes to be behind the action. You know,
letting the film be seen rather than overpowering.
Exactly, you're trying to help tell the story, but you're not the story. So it's
And the title of the second piece that I want to finish up with, All in Light, certainly has a visual and a filmic aspect to it.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the idea. This is solo piano. This is purely solo piano.
Solo piano, yeah.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about the ideas behind this. Again, lovely video, a little bit more abstract than what's there for you, My Father's Son, which is very strong narratively driven.
Exactly, yeah. And that kind of came from the place of the music, because the music didn't have a strong narrative idea for the music. It was more dealing with light and shade, and it was like elements of kind of dreams and nostalgia all kind of tied up with the music, which is what we went for. So Oisin McKeogh was the director for this one, and that was what we were trying to capture with that. So we did that with like lots of prisms to refract the light and kind of give that kind of dreamy visual.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's finish up by listening to a little bit of All in the Light. And this single, All in the Light, is out right now.
Yes.
And you're at the Duncairn Arts Centre in Belfast. Next gig, that's happening.
Exactly.
Yourself and the cellist, Lizzie.
Yeah, myself and Lizzie.
Songs, not just My Father's Son involving...
No, we've kind of gone back and worked some of the other tunes now as well, yeah.
All right. Well, let us listen to pure piano then, piano solo, All in Light from Daniel Luke. Thank you. and Light, the title of that piece, the new single from Daniel Luke. And Daniel performs, as I said, at the Duncairn Arts Centre in Belfast. That gig is on June the 20th. You can find out more details on that and his other gigs, and indeed where to get your hands on his piano music, on daniellukepiano.com. Delighted to be joined in studio right now by poet Fiona O'Rourke. She has just published her ninth collection of poetry called It's called Infinity Pool. It asks questions about poetry, addresses the readers, and has a lot of fun along the way. I was saying to you, Fiona, I had to look up the exact definition of infinity pool just for myself at one point before our chat this evening. Yeah. And like me, you saw loads of these amazing pictures of these pools that kind of go out to the horizon and then they drop off the edge, but they look as if they're continuing on. Did something like that inspire you initially?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's the idea of them rather than the, the experience or any of that. But the idea of them, the idea of this optical illusion whereby what's usually entirely contained within a rectangle is allowed to look as though it spills out over itself out into the world, out into the lake or the forest or whatever it is beyond. And it's a brilliant idea for water to make it look as though it's integrated in the landscape. And I got to thinking about it as an idea, as an image. And I, of course, got to think of the poem as being something that's contained within its own form, usually rectangular, more or less as well.
Yeah.
But that has to spill out over into the world or it doesn't work as a poem. It's got to have a relationship with something that's beyond it.
Well, let's have a listen to the title poem of the collection then, Infinity Pool, from Fiona O'Rourke.
Infinity Pool. I had it in the night, the image, but lacked the energy or will to magic my body through my own fourth wall and lower myself, spit spot, into the page. I saw, I just about recall, a blue rectangle, not quite blank, held up against blue sky, blue sea, so you weren't supposed to tell the edge, the stitching, or the seams. And I am folding it now, this pool, corner to corner, line to line, so as to carry about with me its deep blue scrap of lie. But carrying folded water isn't feasible. You know that.
And that's Fiona O'Rourke with Infinity Pool, title a poem from her new collection. I can't ignore I had it in the night, this image. Do you often dream poems? Was it a dream or was it just where you're sitting down and this thing kind of comes into your head?
Yeah, sometimes you might dream an image more than a poem. You wouldn't dream a whole poem, but you might dream an image, or you might even dream a word. I've had that. I once dreamt a phrase, actually, and the phrase was, as healthy as a pineapple. And I've kind of held on to that because it seems like it's not the worst description of feeling.
Title of your next collection. But, you know, and would you be in those situations? Well, the fact that you still have healthy as a pineapple, that phrase, well, it is a great phrase, wherever it's going to lead you. Would you jot them down somewhere? Would you jump up out of the bed? Did the younger poet in you immediately go to the notebook when such things happened?
The younger poet did. And now I'm just like,
I'm not
actually
dragging myself out of the bed.
Sleep is more important. So I just roll over. And if it's there in the morning, it's there in the morning. And if it isn't, doesn't matter. Something else will come.
Well, you see, that's the voice of experience of, you know, don't be sitting around waiting for inspiration. Yeah. Get on with the writing. The inspiration will come.
Yeah.
I was struck also by, in fact, the very first poem in this new collection, which stands to Tnock, December the 21st. It describes a flight from Stansted to Knock on December the 21st. It's a longish poem, but in essence, what struck me about it was almost that suspended situation of being in the airplane between two places. Is that something like the process of writing a poem, of trying to dig in or fumble around, but nudge a poem into existence?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I suppose when you're setting about writing a poem or thinking about it, you have to see whatever the poem is based on a little differently. So if it's based on an experience, you're not looking to describe the experience, but you're looking to present it maybe, you know, in a different way. So, I mean, what is the best example of being able to see things entirely differently? It's flying. And also, we take flying for granted now. It's almost like being in a bus, but sometimes you just pinch yourself and go, do you know what? This is actually an extraordinary thing to be doing. And there is sometimes, when you're lucky, there's something very beautiful about it. There can be the opposite as well, but sometimes you just hit that moment where you think, this is actually extraordinarily beautiful. And that's the moment that I wanted to write into, this idea that what is going on here? And there's that feeling of being safe and being removed and being able to see things differently. And all of those things are kind of interesting places, I think, to start a poem.
Yeah, because it struck me reading through the collection, my kind of summary of it, if you like, my line into the programme tonight, I think, was this idea that you're looking at, you know, that kind of almost barely visible line between the life of the poem and real life.
Yeah.
You can't just simply sit down and write down your real life experience. Nobody wants to hear that from any of us, let's face it. But there has to be a relationship between real life and the poem's life, or we're not interested. It's too oblique.
Well, that's it exactly. And I've no interest in writing or in reading poems, indeed, that kind of refuse or exclude the reader. I think, you know, you've got, the poem has to have some manners as well. And the poem has to think about, okay, well, how do I appeal to the reader, or how do I recognise or acknowledge the reader in some way? So that was one of the things that I was doing in this book, was kind of turning the poem deliberately back out. It's like it turns an angle. So it's itself, 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 and then suddenly it's kind of back out, thinking about the reader of the poem.
You can't hide in behind yourself, the poem, that is. Yeah. The poem can't hide in behind itself forever and a day.
Yeah.
That's boring for all of us.
Well, it is. Yeah. It is. But at the same time, I think I always want to hold on to the idea that poetry is an aesthetic art form as well. So it's got to have that attention to language and to form and all of those things that make it a piece of art. But at the same time, you don't want it to be so self-contained, as you say, that there's actually no in for a reader.
I think there's quite definitely an in to the second poem that you're going to read for us, the copybook. Anybody of a certain age will remember these copybooks.
Yeah, the copybook. We learned to write in Ashling copybooks, salmon pink or mossy green, with either a fountain pen on the front cover or a round tower over which a single swallow was caught in the act of circling or alighting, who could tell, perched in its green sky, in its black outline, above the tower, which was also black, and gave no hint of the stowed gold or frightened monks inside. One was ruled, the other not. One was for Irish, English, history and geography, the other sums. Though that's where I put the poems, of course. Small poems with red titles in the taut blue grid, like a page of slit windows crossed with iron bars.
Fiona O'Gorke reading from her new collection, Infinity Pool, and the poem that we just heard called The Copybook. You wrote the poems, I'm guessing that this is a true story. You wrote the poems in the sum copy.
Yeah. Yeah. And why would you not? You know, why would you not?
Well, would you not put them in the writing copy?
No, because, you know, okay, so there's the impulse to, as I say, to be orderly, to be neat, to be mannerly, but there's also the interest in resisting all of those things as well. So faced with an obvious option or a less obvious option, I think most poets will go for the less obvious option. And also, there was something that appealed to me about just the neatness of writing in these little squares.
And what did you, like, did you write the words tiny and small into the little squares, or did you put a letter per square, or do you remember?
I think, well, my writing now is tiny, so maybe it came from there.
Yeah. And have you gone back and looked at these? I mean, looking back, no matter what one's job might be, looking back on earlier work, can be a sobering experience.
It can, but it can also be a kind of an extraordinarily helpful experience because sometimes, you know, after 9 books, Sean, sometimes you think, okay, what do I have new to bring to this form? And then you go back and you read something from 20, 25 years ago and you think, do you know what? I actually took a lot of risks when I was starting out with something, which is, I think, something that poets and maybe all art practitioners do, is that they don't know how to immerse themselves in the rules. So they just kind of take a punt on something. They gamble on something. And it's good to remind yourself that that's still an option.
Yeah, because, again, doesn't matter what your job is, you can become complacent and say, look, I know how this will work. Let's get on with doing it the way I know how to do it. Whereas you might have jumped out of the bed when you were younger to write down the thought. You'd kind of let it go now. I suppose it's a good way. It's a good way of checking in yourself.
It is, but you always have to try and make it new. You always have to make sure that each book is different enough from the previous one that there's something new in it for a reader.
One thing I particularly liked in this, you have one poem about not writing a poem. The poem that refuses, and it's a kind of this is a prose poem. I think there are a couple of prose poems in the book, which are kind of, it's almost as if they don't want to be poems. They want to be written not just a straightforward piece of prose. They want to be written in this fashion.
Yeah.
What is the poem that you can't write or won't let itself out of its box at the moment?
Yeah. It's based on an object that exists in the world that I bought in a charity shop, and it's a telegram that was sent to Isaiah Berlin. And I bought the thing and I brought it home and I thought, okay, so now what am I going to do with this? And I just thought, you know what? This thing exists without me. It doesn't need me in the least. I have no role to play in the life story of this telegram object. And so I thought, okay, so can I write in a way that respects the fact that it doesn't want me to do anything because its story is separate to mine? And so what I did was I wrote a poem as an introduction to the poem that never got written. And it was a bit of fun as well to see if I could, if that was possible, really, if it was credible.
Well, it's credible. I mean, it is fun to read that you're saying, oh, here's the poem that I can't write. But has that object left your poetic imagination alone? Or is it like that pineapple line that you gave me at the beginning of our chat? Is it still rumbling around saying, I'll get out, but only when you can find the way that I want to come out?
No. I have it on my mantelpiece and I look at it and I admire it as a very beautiful object in itself, which telegrams from the 1960s were. This is an American one. But I just think, OK, there it is. And I really like the fact that I acknowledge it's the fact that it doesn't need me at all. It's fine. You know, it's fine. I don't need everything to be asking for poems from me because that's not really how it works.
That's
either.
Not real life.
Yeah.
Give me the pineapple line again.
Oh, as healthy as a pineapple.
As healthy as a pineapple. Collection number 10. I'll be talking to Fiona Grocer about it in 5 or 6 years' time. In the meantime, get to Infinity Pool by Fiona, which is published by Gallery Press. And that is our lot for this Wednesday. It is Wednesday. Yes, it is Wednesday evening. Leah Murphy researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. James Feeney was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.